Paul. Welcome to the Bainbridge Podcast.
Hey, Ben. Good to see you.
Good to see you. I've been excited for this conversation. We've known each other now for like, what, 2+ years, I think, when you were a founder of Mudwater, the legendary Mudwater. And I know that you have a lot to share with the audience, but I'm not great at summarizing people's resumes. I would prefer if you could do that and sort of give your background and what you're up to now.
Cool. I hate resumes too. It just always feels like I'm more interested in stuff I want to do now and what I'm going to do as opposed to what is in the past. But I think what's relevant or I guess interesting is I have an interesting background. I really wanted to play professional hockey, and so kind of oriented my entire collegiate career towards going to the only school that gave me any sort of scholarship to play hockey. And I got to play overseas a couple of years. I lost a few teeth. And I think...
I had no idea about this.
Oh, really? Yeah.
No idea.
Most people... Oh, you know what's funny is like how he introduced us. And when I was telling him about that kind of background, he's like, oh, would you play for the Kings or something? And I was like, oh, fuck no. I played in like the worst leagues ever in Europe. And he's like, he was like so disappointed. Man, this guy's like an asshole.
But he's like, wait, did you grow up in Buffalo?
No, I grew up in Youngstown, Ohio. And which is like another funny scenario or situation, just because like Youngstown had like one outdoor rink with no boards and like it wasn't open 6 months out of the year. And so my dad's from Buffalo. He would just like bring me there in the morning and put me on the ice, and I got hooked on it. And I had to like kind of go away to prep school to play competitively. And I just kind of wanted to keep going as far as I could. I think did about as much as I possibly could with my limited ability. But yeah, that was a fun part of my life. And what had a lot to do with why I was attracted to startups when I got back and had to like think about a degree or working or something. And I was like, I'll just try to get a master's degree in finance or something. That sounds interesting. I would read that anyway. And that put me into a practicum course I was at Drexel at the time. And I fell in love with like this class that went to work with a startup, and I didn't have to go to class. Well, that company gave me a job, and they didn't really give me a job. I wanted to work there, and they said, we don't have any money, but if you can make your own paycheck, you can join us. And I just like immediately made the connection of this feels like really competitive athletic team where you're exposed if you don't do a great job. And I get what I put in, and I can work as much as I want, and I see the returns. And once I was in that, environment, it was like no looking back. And it happened to be in like a incubator space at Drexel, and so there was a couple other startups there that were grinding too, and a couple of them did really, really well. And so just being in that circle of people was like, oh man, this is my new spot. So got hooked on startups from a while ago.
Nice. Yeah. So wait, how old were you now, like when you were at your first startup?
This was like 15 years ago, 16 years ago. Yeah. Been a minute.
Yeah. So then what was the path between there and Mudwater? Because there was a few stops, right?
Yeah. I mean, you can never connect the dots moving forward. I think that like the most efficient explanation of the path was probably slowly learning and recognizing patterns in really high achieving people and like what I would call A players, and picking up here and there on like the DNA of these types of people. And for me, our first couple startups did okay. And then we raised the last startup I was running. We raised money from NFX and Founders Fund. And so like really like tier one investors and thinkers too. James and Gigi at NFX were some of the most brilliant people I've ever worked with. And they kind of beat into us like this speed bar that I didn't think I had. So working with them for on, you know, every day for 3 months, very intense kind of crucible. I think, you know, halfway through that, week five, I looked at my girlfriend and was like, I can't keep up with these guys. Like, it's not realistic. And at like week six, our whole team got this like, oh, we can keep up with it. And we started to see that speed really is everything. And like around that time was when we really needed a designer and a UI UX guy. And I went on hired.com at the time and I saw a resume of someone who was like pretty good and only charging like $60 an hour. And I was like, this guy should be charging three times that. Like, He doesn't. And so I'm just going to go hire him. And it ended up being Shane. Yeah. And so he came to meet me and like, we were in the Fidei district at the time, just like, at random cafes, and came to meet me. And let me back up a little bit. So it was Shane. And then I gave him we got a Skype call, and while I was, chatting with him on Skype, I'm trying to find culture fit stuff too. So I found his Instagram and I saw his Halloween costumes, and I was like, oh, this dude's for sure a culture fit. Like, he's hysterical. And, I can't wait to meet him. And, talked to him. I was like, we're looking at this design and here's what we're thinking. It's a really kind of, complex idea, but we think it can be distilled down. And I gave him that directive, not much more. And then it was a few hours later that I got something from him. And I was like, hey, great concept, but this has to be an original design. You can't get it offline somewhere. And he was like, what do you mean? I just went and designed that. And I was like, there's no way you went that fast on this. And he was like, yeah. And he's not somebody who's verbose at all. Like, he's a very humble guy. And I shared it with the team and they were like, what? And then, so we said, hey, you have to work for us, and started working for us. And he was clearly such a talented, amazing guy from every different angle that we collectively decided to make him like our fourth co-founder.
Wow. And,
you know, that company was really fun. Like, we worked on a really cool problem, but we never got it to like a venture return type of scale. And I think what was so sad was the culture that we created there worked really well, but the product didn't get to where we wanted it to go, which is a lesson I learned, very, very painful lesson on when to pivot and how to pivot. And he and I just stayed really good, as really good friends, in touch. Like, what are you working on next? He took another job. I wanted to like try to see if that company could still work. It really was so hard to keep going. And then, but during that time, he was drinking this drink everywhere. He brought it with us everywhere. And he isn't the most hygienic person. He knows that. I'll tell him. And he would never wash his flask. And he's like, hey, Try this. It's amazing. I drink it instead of coffee. And I was like, I'm not drinking that, dude. It's gross. And at the time, he had this like floating chaga mushroom in it. So like this brown floating thing and like not a great flask was like, and I would make fun of him. And like, if you know Shane, he took that very personally, but like all internally doesn't like react.
Putting that on? Interesting.
Just like a couple weeks later, after we wound down the company, he was like, hey, check this out. And he sent me a text, and it was a link to Mudwater's website, which looks like amazingly close to what we have today.
Yeah.
And that's really just a testament of Shane and how he works. And I was like, oh my God. And I had this like immediate reaction of, let's do this. Like, I didn't even know what this was. It was just, I really kind of knew that he was such a special guy and it was so fun to work with him that, I don't care where this goes. Like, I just really need to be back in that, that environment again of working with really great people that go fast, that I love being around. And he was like, basically, I don't even know what this is. And I was like, well, let me help you as much as I can. And he was sending me hundreds of text messages a day. And I was trying to convince him that there might
be. Seriously? Like hundreds?
Yeah. And we've got an early, we'll do a post one day on some of these early messages. Some of the stuff I was sending him was just trash ideas. But I think mostly was there for support. And after like a month or so, I was looking at these testimonials that we were getting from random people that he was sharing it with. And I was like, I cannot believe these testimonials. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
And I was doing his accounting for him. And I was like, hey, I'm sending you money. I'm sending you an angel check. If you don't take this and quit your job, like, I'm not helping you anymore. So I kind of threatened him with my own money.
Yeah.
And that was money I had for a down payment on a house. I'm not an angel investor. It was just like, this feels like I have to do this. And he didn't say anything, but I just wired him the money and told him the next day, check your account. And he was like, I think I'm just, he said something in a text message, like, I just choked up a little bit. And are we doing this? And I was like, yeah, let's go. And 3 months later, we raised like $1 million from some investors and was off to the races.
Yeah, that's awesome. Wow, you just, there's a lot to talk about there. I want to go back though to the company, the NFX founded company. Mm-hmm. You're in this like, they're focused on speed. And what was it that like, what did they mean by speed? Because obviously people are like, oh yeah, go fast. It sounds like you were surprised by how fast they expected you to go or how fast they were working.
Yeah.
So what does that mean or feel like?
Yeah. So the thing that we had to do was we had like 3 meetings with them a week. And from each meeting, they were like, okay, by Wednesday, you need to figure out this thing. And it was not trivial. Right? It's like,
yeah.
And it was like Friday, so you need to figure out this thing. And you had to keep kind of evolving what your pitch deck was going to be. And so they were really big on like language. So like really tight language, saying the same things consistently, if this is what you're going to be doing. And then really tight on information events in a very condensed period of time. And like, if it felt like if we made any excuse for not being able to show something by that future date, then we were going to be like laughed out of the group. And James was constantly like pitching this, like, if you think you have product market fit, you don't. Like, product market fit really does feel like you're being pulled by the market, 2 fingers in your nose, and you know, you can't turn away. And
yeah.
There was a little bit of, I think one of the challenges with us was like when we pitched, and at the time NFX had this like incubator element to it, component to it.
You were in that incubator.
We were in that, yeah.
I see. So you had sort of a peer set of other companies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
A couple of them did.
Wow, so there's like all these competitive elements. It's not just like you and James, but like
totally.
And the
sharpest people that you could imagine, and a lot of companies out of our cohort that did incredibly well, still doing well. And I think I'm actually pretty confident we got the most demo request, or sorry, the most VC requests for a meeting after demo day. And it was because the concept of what we were doing was something that every company wanted and was struggling with, and all these VCs, their portfolio companies were struggling with it.
Yeah.
Which was like this on-demand SDR function.
Right.
And then copywriters, really high-end prospecting, but for a very low cost compared to in-house, not a ton of experience function. The business model was tough to get right at scale. We were trying to teach them this ML AI thing, and we never got to the volume that we needed to show any sort of progress. There was like, we couldn't really prove that we didn't need to raise a lot more money, and that just didn't get us to like a B round.
This
business.
Yeah. What was it that, how did you find that next gear though, between weeks 5 and 6?
You get used to everything, right? Like, humans are just incredibly adaptive. If you're in a stimulus long enough that feels overwhelming, and you're the only variable that either breaks or figures it out, like you break or you figure it out. It was like, I got my schedule down to where I was like, okay, I get up at a weird, I get up early anyway. So I'm like, I'm up at 5, I'm doing a 45 minute workout, and then I'm taking the train from San Francisco to Palo Alto. I'm reading the whole time or working on the deck that whole time. You know, I'm being really efficient in these meetings. The guys know what to build, and I'm prepared, and here's what I figured out. And so that, you know, even just getting the routine was hard, because I was like, I'm just scrambling. I'm not working out. Right. I'm not eating shit. Like, I'm drunk at night because I'm so fucking stressed and like, I don't belong here. And then I was like, okay, get back to basics, like get some sleep, get up early, chip away at this. And like, kind of just not quitting.
Yeah. Can you now turn that off and on? I mean, do you have like one gear, or do you sometimes go faster and slower?
My gears are really kind of dependent on the problem at the time and who I'm working with. So it's like you really have to pull me away if I love the problem we're working on and it's with amazing people. I kind of shut off everything else. I think that's a lot of what sucks about sometimes what I sacrifice unintentionally, and also maybe what makes me like attracted to this type of space at this stage of companies. Like, I can log a lot of raw hours at the beginning. That's when it's really the most fun.
Yeah. Interesting. So going back to MUD, you know, there's so many elements that I, from an outsider, seem to be important to the success, but you kind of brought it right back to the very basics, which was like, you know, the product, like Shane had developed a product, like, you know, that he liked, but then, you know, it sounded like when you were like, yeah, that thing looks terrible. And there's like that, he sort of internalized that, reformulated it to make it more palatable to a bigger audience. Clearly worked, because these testimonials were great. It sounds like he had a natural talent for the presentation of it, you know, being a designer. So what were some of the other elements that, you know, you have these two great building blocks. Do you always have to start there, or can you build in different order, or is it like, no, you got to get them?
Yeah. So there's a couple things that we get this kind of style of question a lot, which is understandable. I think to start, like, there's really not an inauthentic bone in Shane's body. Like, it's really one of the things that makes him awesome to work with. And what that translates to in a brand is that I think the customer can really see the authenticity, and that does matter. And so, like, all that copy was Shane and how he talks. Right? Like, the early stickers that said, like, you know, support your local sunrise, which is just like a brilliant like tagline that I was like, we should probably get that trademark. That's secretly brilliant. And then, like fuck your coffee sticker was in every one of those things. Well, it's really funny, but like the fuck your thing comes from a Burning Man ethos of like, it's not about fuck your coffee more as much as it is like, you know, fuck the thing that you're dependent on that you think you can't. Yeah. You can't live without. Well, that got photographed like hundreds of thousands of times during an unboxing, right? And so there was this like irreverence where we didn't really think, or it was kind of like, if this doesn't become a company, who cares? Like, we're having fun. And he took that approach, and that just came through. And it was like at a time where being a little irreverent just worked, and people wanted to take photos of unboxing experiences, and they wanted brands to represent their lifestyles. And so those are two things. One, it was like, he's really authentic, and that I think that comes through in the brand. Like, he couldn't have really made any other product. Well, not as well, I think. Or if you're going to like make a great product, like, just be authentic with yourself. Is this something like I can't live without myself? Like, can I speak to it organically all the time without having to think? That's a good sign that you might be onto something. The irreverence helped a lot with just photo sharing. And I think what was another thing that just helped a ton was we called it a coffee alternative, and not really to try to like strategize, but it was like, I'm, you know, we're making this because coffee is everywhere, and this is something different, but it's the same ritualistic type of time of the day where we want to introduce something. So
yeah,
it's got to be coffee. And what's subtle about that is we didn't say we were a tea. We have a chai base. We could have said we were a chai based adaptogenic drink, but we said
right.
an alternative. No one was saying that. So you saw this like connection happening for people in their minds of a traditional anchor that they had about tea, right? We're not saying we're a tea. We're like specifically a coffee alternative. So we were able to kind of create this own category that people hadn't thought of before, and we were the only player in it, really. So
right.
we quickly got out in front, and it was like kind of hard to think about anything else in terms of coffee alternative than us.
Yeah. I think that's so interesting, because you could see how you would go to the like, well, we're chai based and it's really more of a tea. So like, how do we kind of like, you know, sound like a better tea? But by just going to this like entirely different place, you just like opened up everything, you know, mm-hmm. and like you didn't have to play by any kind of like what's a tea and what are the rules. Did you find that though in the customer base? Like, were people trying mud that were moving off of coffee, or were these people that were like, oh, I loved all these different types of teas, I'm going to try this mud thing?
We had a couple different types of customers to start, and we still have them today, which was really interesting. I was like, I assumed that everybody drank coffee, and we just had so many customers that were that we had a really evangelical set of customers that came to us and were like, thank God, I never drank coffee. I hate coffee. Tea wasn't enough. This is great.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then we had a post-purchase survey that we ran. We still kind of run it today, which is like, what is your intention with mud? And 70% of people were like, I need to drink less caffeine or less coffee. So you had a lot of people that were like, I know I need to peel it back a little bit. Like, what's this about?
Yeah.
So those were the two big drivers of I would say customer segments that gave us that momentum.
Did that research drive the, I mean, you guys were brilliant at using YouTube, right? Did that drive the ads, or was Shane just like talking about, you know, hey, I'm drinking too much coffee, and it turns out that just fits the target market?
So the first ad, like actual, breadwinner ad that we ran was Shane had to like leave for work, the other job, in like 5 minutes. So he took his iPhone and he videotaped. At the time, we had a clear glass jar as instead of our tin today. And he just videotaped it rotating. And so there was like a live, the ad was like a live video almost. And the ad said, we're not mad at coffee, just disappointed. And so like, it didn't even say what we did. And that ad in the first year and a half, I want to say, made us like $4 million alone. And so you had like, you look at that and how it was made, what it said, what it was doing. It's just hard to kind of productize that thinking. It was like that ad worked for whatever reason. And I think it was because we didn't say what we did. It was a little bit salacious, and like you had to stop it. And I think not saying what we did was provocative enough to get people to stop it and click on it and check it out.
Yeah.
Fast forwarding to when we matured, you know, past like grabbing people on Facebook that'll try anything. You're trying to think now about like, who are we after that will make this consistently a part of their lifestyle and why? And so the founder videos really were like almost like a reaction to customer base in the market saying like, you know, what is this company about? Who is the person that makes it? Where do you get it from? Where did it come from? Like, and Shane, you know, those videos that you see Shane on YouTube that do incredibly well, both in terms of like the substance of the content and even conversions. I mean, those things get filmed in a very short period of time. Back to the charisma thing and the authenticity thing. He filmed that first one on his own phone in a week.
Yeah.
in a few hours. He's really that talented. So
yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
How did you find your place? I mean, you're like, okay, I'm doing the books. I'm a sounding board. I'm forcing you to take my money. how did you find your role?
I just have to use force. I make demands. I think I was helping Shane a lot, and he asked me to be a co-founder, I think, because he saw maybe like working with me at a previous company, what it's like to work with me. I think I'm going to be there working and logging the most hours, kind of show by example. And I can command a lot of responsibilities that are absolutely so different from how Shane's brain works. And we saw this like really fun symbiosis. So I can do finance, accounting, sales, ops, insurance, you know, stuff that he doesn't ever want to look at. Not that insurance is a tough thing, but it's just like, I've done it so many times that, you know, and I can find people that are really, I think, humble and talented, but don't really know it yet. So it was like, Shane's very good at content, branding, design, marketing. And so for a year and a half, 2 years, it was able to be, you know, just really me and him mixing mud till 3 a.m, then doing accounting or branding or whatever. And we were able to wear a lot of hats. So I would say I was really lucky too. I think there was some other people who could have done what I've done better, maybe faster, but we got along really well. And so, and I was helping him. So that's kind of how I fell into a role there.
Yeah, that's interesting. You guys are, I think Mud's approach to fundraising has been the, brilliant and surprising. So surprising that like when I saw your first deck and then subsequently, you know, talk to you more, you know, you're just like, geez, why isn't everybody doing it this way? Right? Like, it just seems so obvious, right? How did you guys figure that out? Maybe if you can are comfortable talking about it, give a little context to what we're talking about and how you approached it. But.
Sure. Yeah. So we're just incredibly defensive of our time, and anything that seems inefficient, like we really think long and hard about it. And if something was like always done a certain way, that's usually like an invitation for us to be like, then we 100% have to do it different. And like, you know, the VC roadshow is like, people complain about it for the same reasons, because it's awful. It sounds awful. It's like,
yeah,
you're losing a little bit of the energy by saying the same things over and over, trying to act authentic and very rote. And you're going to get 100 no's before you get a yes, even with a great product. And so we just thought a lot about like, how do we do a lot of the upfront work now, condense it, and then put it out to a community of investors and say, this is everything we think you should know. If you want to have a phone call with us or meet us, we'd like to get really into the tough questions. Like no dance, like just get into like the really difficult discussions, which we actually really love to do. And I think another thing that really helped us was we put out an investor update every single month for, you know, 24, 36 months, depending on when we were raising. And every single one of those investor updates, we really didn't discriminate at who got it. Like if somebody was interested in us or we had talked to them previously and they were an investor, we put them on the investor update list. You can make an argument.
You didn't ask them. You just added them to the distribution list.
Well, we kind of ask them and they're like, they're always going to say yes.
Right.
Hey, I think just not a lot of companies follow through on delivering every month and then having something every month that shows like real progress. And we were growing very, very fast. So, you know, showing consistently on a monthly basis, the growth and staying on the investor updates also allowed us to say, if you guys have been getting our updates, then we feel like we can get away with a with kind of like a thumbnail here on LTV, CAC, how we think about retention, growth. Here's our high level metrics. And we put all of that into a Notion doc. We did a 1 10-minute pitch in the YouTube video. We put that in the Notion doc and kind of templatized this deliverable to VCs that felt like we were answering the biggest, toughest questions. And there was ability to deep dive on how we thought about everything. And they really appreciated it too. It wasn't coming from a place where we were being dismissive. It was like, here's the things we think are really critical that you should ask about. And so we've already thought about those and here's how we think about it. And
yeah,
a lot of reactions were like, everybody should be doing it this way.
And were they, I guess it's like you're sort of forcing them though to put a lot more work into the, well, I don't know. I mean, maybe they already do a lot of work, but a lot of VCs pitches feel like, you know, you get the great intro, then they schedule.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're coming off of like, you're the seventh call of the day. They walk in, you know, 2 minutes late to the Zoom call.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, go, right? So are they like, you're forcing them to do a lot more pre-work. Were they appreciative of that? Or do you think they were like,
yeah, oh. I think a couple of things. So like these guys do see this pitches all day, every day, you know, all year. So we had a little bit of confidence to think about like what's going to look a little different to them where they're like, oh, you know, that's different. And sure, you might rub people a little bit of the wrong way if it doesn't fall into the traditional way they like to evaluate. But to me, it's like it's a net positive overall for everybody if you're a little bit of a differentiated offer in look at. And so that gave us a little bit of confidence. And I don't think we heard one firm that wasn't receptive to how we laid it out for them. I would also say like our team really did a great job at, if you had a question about retention and you had to go to a partner meeting on Monday, you were not going to have any ambiguity, or they weren't going to have any ambiguity on how we think about it, how we measure it. Is it a gross margin LTV or is it a revenue LTV? Well, it's definitely gross margin, and here's how we calculate it, and here's where we think it's going.
So it's super precise.
Very precise. So there was not, and when we got on this, you know, phone calls, we got really amazing discussions that weren't like getting to know you. It was like,
right,
we disagree with this strategy. Okay, cool, let's talk about it. It got to be like where they were actually really fun calls instead of, not that they're not fun to pitch VCs. It's like, I just do feel a little bit like inauthentic when I'm like, yeah, I have to act as excited as I was 40 pitches ago. And
yeah,
I'm not.
Right. So. And do you think that market conditions, do you think your approach is subject to market conditions? Like, was that like, hey, that was a good way to do it, you know, before everything hit the fan, or would that work as well or better today?
I would do the same thing. Because there's a lot of pageantry in a pitch or a deck, and really this comes down to discounted cash flows. And I'm like, I really want to show you how you're going to get a return on your money. And I do need to show you that we're good at critically thinking about things. And that comes through in text and copy and writing and, you know, deducing a lot of problems down to the first principles. And here's the steps that we're going to go after to tackle these things. And here's where we think shit's going to hit the fan. And especially in later stages, you know, like you want to give the confidence in your potential funding partners that you've thought about a lot of things. It's not a big deal if you disagree. I think what I found is that they want to see how you think about things and that you have thought about them, even if you're not right. It's like, these guys can critically think about really challenging things, and this is a creative solution. That's just really hard to come through in a pitch. So we like putting that in text.
Yeah. That's an interesting point, because it would be really hard to do that. I guess they're sort of testing that through the due diligence process, but you probably don't really understand that until you're like sitting in the board meetings. And by the time you realize like, oh, these guys aren't good at critical thinking.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I don't want to shoot that out there. It's hard to get your money back.
Yeah. This will be my last board meeting. The college kid, he's near new board member. How did you guys through this process though assess your investors? Because you know, so much of that is like, you know, everybody's buddies when you're killing right. it, but you get into the like, oh, that didn't go so well for two quarters, and different type of conversations. So did that approach help you to get to a better understanding of the investors faster?
I think what helped us with investors and just understanding was, you know, we put out a monthly update every month, and there was very clear asks at the beginning, and there's just natural investors where you can move to text messaging with, where you're jammed up and like, there's something to be said for an investor who gives you a lot of money and gets out of the way and says, I'm not going to help you much. However, I'm your biggest investor. And so I help you with money, but that's it. That's okay if you set that expectation up front. And a lot of founders really like that level investor. And then there's other investors that are like, hey, when shit's hitting the fan, there's like only a few that I text, and they're always the people that are like responding or trying to help with your asks and or will jump on anytime. And so, you know, we got to the A round, it was like we're really hopeful or hope that these people can come back in because they've been great. And if we don't know these new investors, we're just going to try to get them validated by other people. Mm-hmm. And something that I learned, you know, I think recently was the better an investor is, the more busy he's going to be or she's going to be. And like, they really want to help you, but you do have to think about like, they're going to assume that you're doing okay unless you call them and say, hey, I'm fucked.
Yeah.
Help me. And they'll help you. So you just have to make it easy for them. And I think when you're screening new investors, if there's competition for the deal, you should ask what's something that you're like really great at helping at, and what can we hold you accountable to helping us with, and how often can we like reach out about that specifically? And we found that like, you know, like a service like Cabal is really great because you can specifically ask certain things to certain people who've said, you know, they're good at these things. So that's something that I've kind of switched my position on. I used to just get like really upset, and it's like the smarter these people are, the more busy they are.
With right.
So you kind of asked for this with getting them. They're incredibly busy because they're smart and they're working on other shit.
Right. Everybody wants their time. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what are you up to now? What are you thinking about?
A couple things. I think Bitcoin is fascinating. So I've just been nonstop reading about this. I have like a little bit of a startup in stealth, I'd call it, with a friend who's
nice.
Very nerdy in Bitcoin. So that's been fun as like a hobby. I really like playing poker and reading. And I'm also still a board member at MUD. And that's been really fun because like I just chatted with Shane this morning for an hour and a half on like a couple of really heavy topics. And so it's fun for me not being in the like day to day or having Slack or email around, because I can walk for a couple hours and think about something before I open my mouth and say something stupid, because like I have to jump into something else.
Right.
So it's been really fun to think long about really difficult problems as a board member and preparing for, you know, board meetings and being like an ally to Shane still, and like, how do I help him? That's been really fun.
Nice.
So, and reading a lot, just like trying to figure out like next thing I want to read, what am I taking notes from? And I help a lot of startups now. So I'm an investor in over 20 companies.
Nice.
And I'm able to kind of reach out to those companies and say, what's the biggest thing I can help you with right now? Like, no, really, literally tell me your biggest problem and let me think about it for you. And that's kind of turned into a little bit of a service that I didn't
think
I was going to have, but it's been really fun to go help startups too.
How accurately can founders, 20 founders, how accurately can they answer that question?
I think what's been really telling where for me, which is like, oh, I think maybe I really am onto something here, is like, I've been saying the same stuff for a long time, and I really love founders, but now that Mud has like this kind of like external success thing, it buys me a little bit more of like buys them a little bit more of a canvas with me, where they can really open up and say, I'm actually really struggling with this. And it usually has something to do with, you know, the challenge of being a founder and the psychological baggage, right? Like Ben Horowitz says, the most difficult thing is managing your own psychology. So I can kind of like go in there and quickly get this answer that is like coming from a coach and a mentor and investor and like an operator at the same time. So I find that I get like a very rich type of answer around like what's really keeping them up at night. And it's always like just a handful of things. Like, I think I've gotten like, I'm getting better at like separating those things from like, you know, there's really no boogeyman here. We can really unpack a few of this to a few things and like, let's individually tackle them. And
yeah,
that's been really rewarding and fun and feels very purposeful. So,
but you just like, it's like you're at 5 minutes to go. You're like leaving the cliffhanger here. You're like, oh, it all just comes down to these handful of things. Like,
I'll deliver it in 5 minutes. Like, it's very simple. There's so much that has to do with A players. I can quickly assess, even with mannerisms when they talk about their team, like, that's not an A player. Oh, well, you need to give them more work. That's an A player. And it's so hard for a founder to be like, I need to fire somebody and then actually go do it. That has actually a lot to do with it. There's probably some people in your organization that are not performing, and that's taking so many energy points away from you, and they know that. And so I try to help them think through like, you're not a bad person. Let's put this person's not thriving either. Let's find a spot for them somewhere.
It's a super hard lesson to learn.
So hard. And so I've been calling it like a thrive audit. And like, because they're not thriving either. And then in CPG, there's only a handful of levers you can pull, really. And so it's like, if your model is working and trustworthy, then we can look at some ratios where you're going to get these asymmetrical returns on fixing them. Like, you might not be able to move margin a lot. You may be able to move like, I don't know, ratios in terms of like payables or headcounts, stuff that's like really unsexy, that, but together, like, you've moved some material, net income at the end of the year. And so, it has a lot to do with that. And some of these founders are really brilliant. They just got out of their zone for some reason. And so it's like, what do you want to be the best in the world at? And if you're the CEO, you by default have to not run out of cash. You have to constantly be pitching the story. You have to be the best in the world at recruiting. So if you're not going to be good at those things, that's okay. We have to fire you from that and get the best in the world is. And what's the one thing you want to be great at? And let's make sure your calendar shows up and kind of supports that thing. I think like just getting a handful of those into their like day to day, you know, you get these testimonials like, holy shit. It's like, you knew you had to do it. You just needed a little kick or like,
And so are you doing that as like, is that sort of this consulting that you were referencing, or is that as an investor? Or
I had to call it that. Until I come up with a different word. Yeah, we can call it. But it's like a coaching / I don't know. It's like people were saying, "Can we pay you for your time?" And I was like, "Well, yeah, that sounds good. Let me put together a company to bill you through or something." So it was kind of like reluctantly created. I just love talking to founders. Like, I would honestly pay them to get to chat with them and hear about their ideas. It feels so like, it's such an honor to be a part of somebody's dream, right? I know I'm going to be a part of their, I'm like in the front row of watching the next great thing being created. Like, it's way more interesting than a movie. So like,
yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
Well, Paul, thanks so much. It's been awesome. It flew by for me. And I feel like I learned a lot, which I guess I always do when when I'm with you, but worth saying again.
Likewise, man. I love what you guys are doing. Such a cool product.
Thanks.